You're listening to Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Remember back in March of 2020, as the pandemic began, when face masks were just starting to be a thing, and you weren't even really sure where to buy those face masks? Well, that's when Christina Wong took action.
You know, sometimes these things happen in the world and you can try to push forward like they're not happening, or you surf them and you surf and ride them. And here's a situation where I... One thing led to another, and suddenly I was running a national mutual aid group.
Wong, a Koreatown performance artist who suddenly had no work, surfed the situation by making masks in her apartment. She got her friends involved, and their friends, and families. And soon, the so-called anti-sewing squad included people from all across the country, making masks for hospital workers, migrant workers, and more. And when the mask-making died down, the storytelling began. And now, eight times a week, on stage in New York City's East Village, Wong recounts how she sparked a mini-movement at her red Hello Kitty sewing machine in Koreatown. Reporter Juliana Mayo checked out the show.
Thanks to all kinds of great reviews in the New York Times and elsewhere, Christina Wong, Sweatshop Overlord, is one of the hottest tickets in town.
Of my sewing space in Koreatown, Los Angeles.
Christina Wong owns the room in this black box theater, surrounded by oversized candy-colored sewing implements. She prowls the stage in a jumpsuit with a bandolier of thread spools, telling the story of her pandemic project turned social movement, the Auntie Sewing Squad. And she does it on a stage that helped launch shows like Rent, Hadestown, and most recently, Slave Play, the New York Theater Workshop. So, no pressure.
Oh my God, so exciting. It's so unreal. It's like, how did I...
Her aim when starting the Auntie Sewing Squad was simply to get masks to people who badly needed them, not land an off-Broadway show.
And it's just sort of, it's a silver lining in a truly time.
Initially, she didn't think the mask shortage would last long. Here's how she explains it on stage.
I'm going to make my own small, manageable Facebook group. I'm not going to put the words COVID or mask in our name. I don't want this to become a massive operation that hijacks my entire identity or something. Okay, this is just a three-week thing until the cargo ships from China show up and the government distributes the masks. So, all right, how about we call ourselves something with Auntie in the name?
It would be 540 days before they were done sewing. If you recall, in the beginning of the pandemic, fabric and elastic were hard to find. Wong and her aunties were very resourceful, cutting up sheets and getting fabric donated from all kinds of unlikely places.
Now, I have not created this group to become a news story, but our details do read like the perfect human interest story, like how these Lao Buddhist monks in Richmond, California, gave us their saffron monk robes to be cut into masks, this sacred fabric which has been worn to bless so many things in, now making its way onto the faces of immigrants and farm workers. So symbolic-y, right? Or like how Auntie Leilani cuts up her hula costumes to go into the first batch of masks headed to the Navajo Nation, one culture on the brink of erasure trying to protect another culture that is literally being erased.
Wong's show reminds us that during the early days of the pandemic, COVID wasn't the only thing people were afraid of. America has also seen a dramatic rise in anti-Asian hate crimes.
Personally, I am not wearing masks right now because I am trying to protect myself. Not from the virus, but from being the target of harassment and assault. You see, it doesn't matter if I'm third generation Chinese American. This is a mask I cannot take off. It already says, maybe I'm an immigrant from the monolith. That is Asia. Maybe I don't speak English. Maybe I'm the one who brought the virus here. So I protect myself by not wearing a mask.
Audience members overwhelmed by the stories of hate crimes Wong discusses in the show often approach her afterwards, grateful for the light she shines on them. Wong says that makes sense.
I realize that we haven't had really a lot of public space to process this aside from maybe a news story where we talk about all these hate crimes are happening, or we go to a march and we're like screaming and screaming. But the theater is its own kind of specific space for shifting and processing, right? Because you can sit and it's story, it's a little slower, and it's a lot more mutuality, I think, shared between the performer and the audience.
For Wong, it's important to memorialize everything from those 18 months, the good, the bad, and especially the people who showed up.
When I saw all these women, especially Asian American women, working so hard at their sewing machines and sewing and sewing and sewing, I was just like, please let history remember that we did this work, right? Like, just capture that we did this. And I, you know, I don't need us to be like super famous and have our own whatever, the Smithsonian would be nice. But, you know, I just want history to remember that Asian American women stepped up and did this work.
A lot of work. By the time it was over, they'd sewn over 300,000 masks, a vast movement that began in a tiny L.A. apartment.
I am really proud that this kind of solidarity work came out of L.A. and came out of Koreatown.
So what's next? Well, L.A., if anybody's got an empty theater out there, she sure would like to find a way to bring her show back home for you to see. For Greater L.A., I'm Juliana Mayo.
By the way, should you find yourself in the Big Apple in New York City, Christina Wong, Sweatshop Overlord, runs through the 21st at the New York Theater Workshop.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiatakis. It has been more than a year since the 2020 census wrapped up, and those numbers, population and demographics, are factoring into political districts. Well, that has redistricting implications all over the country and right here in LA County and the rest of California, too. It is a process that involves commissions and public hearings and, yeah, a good bit of wrangling, political wrangling. Joining me now to help us make sense of the process and what it means is John Rigardi, who covers City Hall for Los Angeles Magazine, and Paul Mitchell, who owns Redistricting Partners Incorporated. Welcome to you both.
Thank you, Steve.
Thanks for having us.
All right. So starting with you, John, this process for redrawing the LA City Council district boundaries, this has been really contentious. Remind us how this process works. It starts with an independent commission, right?
Well, theoretically, an independent commission. Essentially, what's happened is many, many months ago, by the nature of this, the city council and other local politicians appoint members to a 21-person panel. This panel has months and months of meetings in which they are seeking to redraw the 15 council district boundaries based on U.S. Census results. Now, Steve, let's be clear. This is really hard work. You have to create 15 districts, each with about 260,000 people. And map makers have to take into account geographic, racial considerations, communities of interest have to be kept together, others push for economic engines to be kept in their district. There's a lot that goes into it, so there's clearly a lot of opportunity from the very beginning for discord.
And the commission, John, is supposed to be independent. How are these commissioners chosen?
Well, the 15 council members, they each get to appoint a member to the commission, and other politicians also get to appoint members to the commission. And this is really where things get kind of wacky and kooky, and they have over many, many months. Because as this redistricting commission had all its meetings, and you would start to hear about various maps and drawings come up, every so often, suddenly a commissioner would be replaced. One of the city council members would say, you know what, I want to have someone else on this commission. Why was that? Maybe that the council member wasn't seeing the results they wanted in draft maps. So you wound up with this situation where there were really questions as to how independent this was. And in fact, even after the commission turned in its final maps, it gave a report, and the head of the commission in that report said, you know what? Next time you guys do council redistricting in 10 years from now, you really need a full independent process, not one where politicians can meddle and change their appointees to this panel.
Paul, how similar is this to what John just explained? You know, on a statewide level, how, I mean, are we talking independent commissions? Are we talking about the state legislature getting involved?
Yeah.
How does it work?
Yeah, I mean, I think the city council kind of co-opted that independent label for a process that it honestly isn't independent. And full disclosure, I was the demographer for the commission as it developed its draft maps, but I'm not involved in the process that goes to the city council. The county is a true independent commission. It is appointed independent of the politicians. It's not like supervisors pick their best friends or fundraisers or neighbors to be on the commission. And when they pass the plans, unlike the LA City redistricting, they are the final plans. Same thing's true with the state. 14 commissioners selected through an independent, really outstanding process to ensure that they get a good quality set of people to do the work. And when they draft the plans and finalize them, the legislature doesn't have to come back behind them and approve anything. It is the lines that will be in place for the next 10 years, and it's final. So independent commissions should really be thought of both in how they're appointed, how they run, and also the fact that they have the final say on the lines that are implemented. And that's coming out of this commission process. What the executive director and the chair asked for is that for the next redistricting, that they go to a fully independent process.
So, John, bringing you back in, talk about some of the backroom wheeling and dealing that's been going on with these city districts, the city council districts. At one point, I know the council president, Nuri Martinez, came out strongly criticizing the map, right? What was she so upset about?
The thing that probably got most people, you know, really concerned or confused was that after months and months of meetings and discussions from the commission, the maps that came out essentially designated 13 districts, and then there were a pair of districts that were labeled either 2 or 4 or 4 or 2, as the panel didn't decide which should go to Councilmember Paul Krikorian and which should go to Nithya Raman. Either way, if that map had been adopted, one of the two was likely to end up with a district that was mostly new to them, and the other would have had a district entirely new to them. So they were furious, and then Council President Nuri Martinez, as you referenced, she was also unhappy. She asserted that a number of voices just hadn't been heard in the process. So that's when she went and took this additional step of creating a new council ad hoc redistricting commission, where the council members essentially took over, said, okay, we're the cartographers now. And while much of the commission map that had been previously drawn was utilized, other elements were largely redrawn, including districts 2 and districts 4.
Another battle, John, was over the Exposition Park area, which includes USC, the Memorial Coliseum, Bank of California Stadium. There were a couple of different council members who wanted that area to be in their district. How did that play out?
Well, once again, this this is an area that we also saw a big fight over back in 2011 when some of these key assets were moved. Yes, essentially, USC and Exposition Park are, you know, key economic assets, real big drivers, and both Curran Price, who represents the 9th district, and Marquise Harris Dawson, who represents the 8th district, they both wanted these territories. And the really big fight was over Exposition Park. Both at this moment are in the district of Curran Price. Marquise Harris Dawson has indicated that he's going to continue to try to fight, but it's unclear if he will be able to get any of these assets back in his district.
Paul Mitchell, on the congressional level, do you see any big changes happening for districts around Southern California?
Well, yeah, absolutely. I think the biggest is that in the first draft of the congressional maps that the commission put out, we knew that they were going to go from 53 seats for Congress in California down to 52. But what we didn't expect is that they would use that as an opportunity to eliminate the most Latino district in the country. The seat currently held by Congresswoman Luis Roybal Allard has essentially been eliminated in this current draft. I think it's important for your listeners to understand that the state gained population, most quickly gained Latino population, then second place essentially in growth was the Asian population. Where we lost population in California was with white population. We lost 5% of the state's white population. I don't think it's a good remedy for that loss in white population to come in and just eliminate a Latino majority minority district from the Los Angeles area. But that's what's in the current draft. And I think the commissioners right now have already expressed a desire to come in and try to make some changes to the congressional district map that they have for Los Angeles in order to essentially put back that VRA seat. And our hope is that, you know, they can come up with new maps that won't reduce voting rights for Latinos or African Americans. One of their early drafts had a elimination of the Karen Bass district. I don't think either of those are appropriate remedies for, you know, the need to eliminate a district in the state.
One term that we hear over and over again, Paul, is gerrymandering. And it does happen in other states, many other states. And it happens on both sides of the political aisle. Is it still happening? And how does that factor into who wins what seats?
It is still happening in California. I don't think gerrymandering is happening with our state redistricting commission, but it sure is happening in local and city and county redistricting around the state. And it obviously happens a lot around the country. And we talk a lot about partisan gerrymandering, where you're drawing lines to favor one party or another. Then there's also racial gerrymandering, where you're using lines to split up a Black or Asian or Latino or Armenian community and essentially disenfranchise them, you know, really cut off their ability to elect candidates of choice. And the third is this kind of pernicious, what I call amenity gerrymandering, where, you know, they're gerrymandering, but it's for this weird, selfish stuff where an incumbent says, well, I definitely want to have that Mexican restaurant in my district, and I have to have that business in my district, or I have to have that donor in my district. The other one, obviously, that I skipped over was incumbent gerrymandering, where you're, you know, drawing districts that really have no sense to them or their lines, except to make sure that the elected officials can continue to run for office.
Paul Mitchell owns Redistricting Partners. John McGarty covers City Hall for Los Angeles Magazine. Thanks to you both for coming on today.
Thank you, Steve.
Thanks for having us.
Onward now with Greater LA on KCRW. Steve Chiotakis here. And before you leave us today, you know, the Southland is known to the world as its entertainment capital, but it's also the capital of so many other things. Helicopters and police chases, god-awful traffic, sports champions, well, not this year, and great food. And while the Wolfgang Pucks and Gordon Ramsays of the world get their famous restaurants noticed all over the place, there are mom-and-pops, hole-in-the-wall places, food trucks that don't. Well, that's where the hood foodie comes in. Alexander Orozco started an Instagram a few years back to pay tribute to food spots off the beaten path in neighborhoods from the valley to all over Los Angeles, and he's amassed tens of thousands of followers all along the way. But the journey to get there hasn't been easy, including bouts of depression and even the thought of taking his own life. And the hood foodie himself joins us right now to talk all about it. Hey, HF.
Yeah, what's up, familia? What's up, man? How you guys doing?
You didn't originally set out to get an Instagram account and start shooting videos at different restaurants and taco stands and everywhere else across Los Angeles. You were doing something else, right?
Oh, no, yeah, I was lost. At 36, I didn't, you know, I thought I was done. I didn't see any direction. I didn't have a career. I got tired. You know, it's how they say it. You know, like, people can try to push you, but it's not until you decide that you want things done a different way that, you know, shit happens. So it's like, for me, I got tired. You know, one of my things was I needed to get away from alcohol because it played a huge role in my household. You know, it basically took out my dad. So, and, you know, I was a binge drinker. Now I'm 6 years sober.
Congratulations.
Appreciate you, friend. You know, it was bad. Like, you know, I would start drinking. I wouldn't end till 6 in the morning. I would, you know, ooh, crashes, jail. Dude, one day, you know, I got woken up at the Jack in the Box in San Fernando by the cops at the drive-through window. I was knocked down waiting for my food.
Yeah.
So, you know, so then, you know, I started training myself. And from one day to the next, you know, I stopped drinking. And then I took it, you know, upon myself. I'm like, you know, this is probably the time for me to start working on myself, period. So went to a psychiatrist. They diagnosed me with bipolar depression. First time that I took medication. And a week later, I found myself at work at lunchtime, inside my truck, contemplating suicide due to the side effects of the medication. And the only reason why I didn't drive off was because there were so many cars in the parking lot that we double parked. So God knows what would have happened if that vehicle wasn't in front of me. And then it was already difficult as it was that, you know, I had to call my wife and tell her, hey, babe, like, I'm over here trying to take my life away. You know, that wasn't easy on its own. She was like, please stay where you're at, you know, till the end of the day that, you know, till I can get you some help. And yeah, sure enough, you know, I ended up at Mission Community Hospital in the hood of Panorama City on a 5152 hold. And all they were doing was just feeding me meds. And for months, I was a cabbage, you know, because of the side effects. You know, I had my kids on one ear, my wife on another, like, you know, come back to us. We love you. Be your happy self again. Social media was hitting hard and Instagram just started. So then I was like, you know what? I think I was looking for an outlet to kind of distract me from everything that I had just gone through. So it just so happens I was like, dude, I could probably take pictures and post them and see what happens.
But were you thinking of pictures of food?
Oh, yes, of course. Yes, food. Yeah. But it just so happens that I was at Lenchitas in Pacoima, Carrillo's in San Fernando, like all these little mom and pop shops. And then right away, I get kicked out to L.A., the mecca of the foodie world. And we start blowing it up there. Certifying restaurants, creating dishes with the people I was helping support.
When somebody watches one of your videos, what do you want them to know? What do you want them to see? Is it about you? Is it about the community?
I want to highlight the beauty of the hood. You know, I mean, people somehow see me as a motivational speaker or I inspire people. Some people look at me as a mentor. Nobody is doing it like we are doing it. And I feel like we're the biggest Latino foodie. No, it's just me, myself, and I.
You just go out with your phone and take videos?
My wife actually helps. Yeah, yeah. Sometimes I'll show up to places like, oh, man, like, where's all the production crew? I'm like, oh, I have it right here in my hand. I'm ready to go. You know, but
and your wife helps you, too.
I have to give credit. Yeah, I have to give credit where credit is due. My wife is my videographer. I mean, I've gone through so many, and she's always, for some reason, the one that always captures the essence. So, yeah, she's my go-to.
What's your favorite food? What is it you can't go without?
I grew up with Mexican, so I have to. I mean, Mexican for me is it's the nostalgic, you know. Like, but caldo de res, carne en su jugo. For me, dude, lengua. Oh shit, man! Like the other day, we went to my cousin took me to a spot in Pacoima, right? What was it? Restaurante Marias. Dude, that was like I was looking through the menu and it just popped out. Lengua. I was like, oh man, I gotta try this. And dude, small hole in the wall place. Like it seemed like everybody like knew each other's name, because even like the waitress already knew people's orders, and like very, very, you know, casero, like, you know, like homie, you know?
Yeah, you know, I want to ask you about a taco truck that you visited recently too. It's a place called Chief's Tacos. Rick Ganivet is the guy known as Chief, and he runs this taco truck that he parks right outside of his antique store. That sounds like a pretty unusual combination. Tell us about Rick.
Food has always been in his blood. He actually had a dream 10 years ago to actually start up a taco stand. But, you know, the opportunity came up of owning the antique store. Like many, many stories that I've heard in many of these hoods, is that the pandemic actually pushed a lot of people to, you know, people are living out their dreams now. And one of them was Chief.
What kind of tacos is he making in Whittier? And why is it so popular?
They are known for the quesadilla frita. It's the basically a deep fried quesadilla, and they just stuff it with cheese. So the traditional way that they do it is either chicharrón or chicken. But he gives you the option to do carne asada. But no, like that day, I had to try the chicharrón. Oh man, that it was bomb, fam. It was bomb.
God, dog.
You know, they're authentic, traditional tacos. Everything made from scratch. I mean, you get high quality meats. But not only that, man, you get the love.
I want to thank you for coming on. Alexander Orozco, the Hood Foodie. You can find him on Instagram at the Hood Foodie. Thank you, my friend.
Nah, man. You know, thank you guys, because you guys are giving me a voice. And tell them that the Hood Foodie sent you.
You just did, actually. You just did, Hood Foodie. That's all the time we have for today. Next week, a school in the Inland Empire established to educate and assimilate Native American kids is now a place for cultural preservation. And we'll hear from actor and comedian Steve Martin. He talks about the movie L.A. Story. Remember that one? How does it hold up 30 years later? That's next week on GLA. Hope you'll tune in. Grab the podcast anytime. KCRW.com/GLA. You can also find our show wherever you get your podcasts. Rebecca Mooney, Sonia Geis, Ray Guarna, Phil Richards, Amy Todd, Danielle Chiriguayo, Sue Margulies, and Christian Bordahl all helped put the show together this evening. I'm Steve Chitikas. Thanks for your time and attention. Have yourself a great night.